You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, July 11th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, pinch hitting for Sam Steeder on the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Ari Paul, journalist, analyst on the Chilcot Report, British politics, U.S. politics, and the crisis of accountability and power. We'll connect the dots between Chilcot and the policing crisis, the policing catastrophe in America. Jimmy Dore, my buddy Jimmy Dore, the great comedian, he'll be on as well. We'll be talking about, probably also make fun of Tony Blair. There's a new Tony Blair character that needs to be debuted. Also, we might go over some of the absolutely nauseating but totally unsurprising accusations against Roger Ailes. Like, I would be shocked if Roger Ailes didn't do this stuff. Like, if somebody came up to me and they're like, hey, you know what? Roger Ailes isn't a serial sexual harasser, and I have proof. I'd be like, what? Are you serious? Roger Ailes doesn't do that? Wow. But it looks like this is a case where the obvious is obvious. We'll talk about that and more with Jimmy Dore. And on the fun half, I don't know how fun it will be. We will obviously talk about the events of last week. Policing, race, the two murders that we saw, the killings of police officers in Dallas, where we are at, the cultural implications, the policy implications, the blueprint we need. Saudi religious leader goes to the roots of the Quran, that supposedly unchanging, immutable, evil book, and calls for significant reforms in Saudi Arabia and starts getting death threats. Yes, from religious fanatics, but also because those religious fanatics' power is threatened by the reforms he's calling for, because everything is about power and politics, less so about belief. Also check in on Iraq. The crisis continues there. Is the crisis that was revealed even more so again by Chilcot, the catastrophe in the UK, and why don't we have a process of accountability like that here in the United States? All that and more on today's Majority Report. We're back from vacation. Sam did a great show on Friday. We posted it for members only. Obviously, great idea if you can to become a member of this program. So he was able to touch on a lot of, you know, just this, what had unfolded. I mean, it was a very weird time to be on vacation last week. I just want to say, really briefly, I think that when you see videos like the killing of Alton Sterling, like the killing of Philando Castile and Minnesota, you have to ask yourself, and I would say primarily as a white person, frankly, do you want to in some sense be like a cultural accessory to murder and try to justify and obfuscate and distract from the reality of what those videos tell you? And to even call it a crisis is misleading, because crisis implies that it's a deviation from the norm. This is a norm in the history of American policing. I'll add the usual caveat that obviously it does not include all officers. Obviously, it does not, you know, mean that there isn't a function that's important for public protection and all the rest of it. But we need to confront this issue, and we need to think of it not as, I mean, it is a race issue, and it is an issue that affects Black and Hispanic people disproportionately, but it's an American issue, it's a societal issue, and it's very much, you know, a white issue, frankly. you know, the rush with All Lives Matter and all the rest, and they attempt to obfuscate what you see, is playing a cultural function that generates the umbrella for these things to happen. And it's not about demonizing police, it's not about demonizing everybody, but it is about getting very, very serious about the policy roots, which include, we got to start targeting prosecutors that don't bring charges against police, period. That's a, that is a urgent policy priority. And it includes a cultural conversation where the basics of reality are acknowledged. Like, if you're white, you have a different relationship to police than if you're black. Like, you know, we can joke about it and people being overly PC or whatever, but white privilege and all the rest is just a reality. This is not like some abstract debate. 2 + 2 = 4. White privilege exists. How are we going to address it? We'll obviously get to a lot more of this, but I really wanted to just state that up front. And we have to work on these issues. I'm glad to be back on break, from break. Glad to see Matt Kelly. Really quickly, before we get to Ari, how is everybody doing?
I am feeling great. I was up, I covered about 1,000 miles from the upper northwestern part of North Dakota to Minneapolis, and it was nice. Good to see that part of the country again.
Never seen that part of the country. Want to.
I'm good.
Good? It's so weird with this new computer setup.
Yeah.
I can see you now when you're on the mic.
Right. I can hide when...
When you're like rolling your eyes and stuff?
No, I never roll my eyes. What are you talking about?
Okay, then. There's nothing wrong with we're all...
It is a little bit weird because I do...
culture of eye rolling in this office.
I do watch the show now from the screen, which makes it even more...
You're on a second delay.
Mediated.
I'm not on a delay from because it's from the actual recording software, but how Matt described when you do video, you think of the show in clips. It gets even...
It rewires your brain.
One step removed when you just watch the show that's happening right in front of you on your computer.
No, I've done it too. It is a little weird. All right, we will be right back with Ari Paul on the Majority Report.
Some people you're right, and them still choose to show you hate. Cha, run them out of your yard. From them a play bad young, I them a backbiters. Hypocritical, too sideless. We call them modern day Judas. The spreaders of rumors. Oh, them a backbiters. Hypocritical, too sideless. We call them modern day Judas. Spreaders of rumors. Hey, hey, so why should I be afraid of you when you bleed just like I do? The more you try fight, judge, your light keeps shining through. So I've got no time for you, cause in my view, you wanna step in on my shoe. You wish you never leave a loo and feel so damn confused. How every day you wake, you ache because you know you're fake, and every step you take, I bring you closer to your grave. But I am like a column when I easily shake. Me certain say I feel me none of who no can take. We guided by the monster, defender of the faith. Yes, ordained to be great. Hold them a backbiters. Hypocritical, too sideless. We call them modern day Judas. The spreaders of rumors. Hold them a backbiters. Hypocritical, too sideless. We call them modern day Judas.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Ari Paul. He's a contributor to The Forward and a journalist, labor organizer, many, many things, man of many trades. Ari, how you doing? Thanks for joining me.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So I want to start by going over back across the pond. It's been such an insane week, and obviously because of, you know, these murders we saw and policing and race issues are at the forefront in the United States right now, and we will connect to them. But, you know, what the last week began with, I think from a sort of global and perspective that sort of connects these threads is power and accountability. So we started with the Chilcot Report, which was an official government investigation that took 7 years to complete of the UK's role in the invasion of Iraq, and specifically Tony Blair's role as the leader who helped along with, you know, was the sort of driver of the invasion along with George W. Bush, obviously. The report was devastating, as devastating as a report like that is going to be. And before we get to, we'll touch on Blair, but we're going to start with Jeremy Corbyn, who is the current leader of the Labour Party. That's Tony Blair's party. And there has been a active drive to depose him following the EU referendum vote. And I think we can see by this response to the Chilcot report that he gave in the House of Commons that this desire to get him out might have had a bit more to do with him not delivering this speech. So let's play this sound and then I'll get your thoughts on it, Ari.
The war was not in any way, as Sir John Chilcot says, a last resort. Frankly, it was an act of military aggression launched on a false pretext, as the inquiry accepts, and has long been regarded as illegal by the overwhelming weight of international legal opinion. It led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and the displacement of millions of refugees. It devastated Iraq's infrastructure and society. The occupation fostered a lethal sectarianism, as the report indicates, that turned into a civil war. Instead of protecting security at home or abroad, the war fueled and spread terrorism across the region. It's led to a fundamental breakdown in trust in politics and in our institutions of government. The tragedy is that while the governing class got it so horrifically wrong, many of our people actually got it right. Many on February the 15th, 2003, 1.5 million, spanning the entire political spectrum, and tens of millions of other people across the world, marched against the impending war, the biggest ever demonstration in British history. All those who took the decisions laid bare in the Chilcot report must face up to the consequences of their actions, whatever they may be. Later today, I'll be meeting a group of families of military servicemen and women who lost loved ones, Iraq war veterans and Iraqi citizens who've lost family members as a result of the war that the US and British governments launched in 2003. I'll be discussing with them, our public and the Iraqi people, the decisions taken by our then government that led the country into war with the terrible consequences. Quite bluntly, Mr. Speaker, there are huge lessons for every single one of us here today. We make decisions that have consequences that don't just go on for the immediate years, they go on for decades and decades afterwards. We need to reflect very seriously before we take any decisions, again, to take military action without realising the consequences of those will live with all of us for many decades to come and have often incalculable consequences as a result.
And it's so weird, Ari, because I had heard that Jeremy Corbyn was an anti-Semitic Stalinist. But I want your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, the recent push to depose Corbyn, the failed push, we should underscore. He really is one of the only British party leaders continuing to stand tall in the whole Brexit campaign. Right. This push, you know, isn't just because of Brexit. In fact, that's a fairly superficial way to look at it. There's been a huge, I mean, almost existential crisis within the Labour Party with the rise of Corbyn. When Corbyn put himself in the running, there was a slew of articles in the British press about how from the Labour centre, in order, you know, the necessity to keep Corbyn out and to keep the old left of the Labour Party from coming, you know, to an ascendance. And a lot of that has to do, of course, with the ideological centering of the party, but a lot of it does have to do with the examination of the Labour Party, and particularly Tony Blair's role in the Iraq War. You know, as Mr. Corbyn said in that speech, we don't know exactly what the consequences for the people who perpetrated this war are going to be. At the very worst, there could be war crimes, you know, charges, which there are some of the British press who speculate that the coup against Corbyn was less to do with Brexit and more to do with protecting any legal action that could come Tony Blair's way, or at the very least, to protect him from his lasting legacy as someone who forced a deadly, horrible, costly war onto the British people through lies. So it is a protection effort on the behalf of Blair's allies and for him, but also very much to keep the ideological wing of the party centered to where he brought it in the 90s.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, there's a couple of parts to this. We'll take the Labour Party a bit more and then we'll sort of broaden it. So basically, it seems like what has saved Jeremy Corbyn, and I want to be clear, I think that there are, you know, there might be legitimate questions about his performance as a national candidate, right? Like, I don't think we should oversell, you know, his abilities as a political performer and, you know, all the rest. But at the same time, what he's undeniably done through being right about all these major issues and having integrity and being clear on any number of issues, from austerity to the Iraq invasion, is absolutely revitalized and generated enthusiasm in the Labour Party and the grassroots, while internally he has almost no support, very little support, from the other members of Parliament who represent the Labour Party. Previous leaders, not just Tony Blair, have been gunning for him. So has it been that's what saved him, is that he has sort of established a direct relationship with the grassroots that supersedes these, you know, very mediocre and unpopular politicians in most cases?
Yeah, I think sometimes as Americans, we need to kind of take a step back a minute and remember that the Labour Party isn't just like the Democratic Party, where you check a box and say, I'm in the Democratic Party and I'm going to vote in its primary every 4 years. To be a member of the Labour Party, you apply and you become a member of the party. And that means taking on certain responsibilities and taking on a certain ideological identity. You are officially connected to the party in a very in a very solid way. And from what I read in some sources in the British press, since Corbyn has ascended to shadow prime minister, he has added something like 200,000 to 300,000 rank and file members of the Labour Party. I mean, this time last year, people were lamenting the fall of the Labour Party. It had lost all of Scotland, one of its traditional bases, to the SNP, precisely because the people of Scotland were steadfastly against austerity, and the Labour Party was sort of offering a austerity light program to the general public of the United Kingdom, and so he has connected to working class unease about where the country is going, and they're coming back in the Labour Party. Now, personally, I was against Brexit. I think it's going to be a terrible thing for Britain in many respects. But let's acknowledge this: there were a great many people in the UK suffering from austerity, and when only the far right is coming to them with an agenda, they're going to go to that agenda because they're the only agenda that is reaching out to the anxieties of working class and poor people. Now, it would just be considered politically ludicrous for the Labour Party to say, no, let's keep doing what we're doing, going down the middle, ignoring these outrages, and just telling them that hope is just around the corner. Corbyn actually does at least attempt to connect to that unease. And
absolutely,
it would be, I think it would be political suicide for the Labour Party establishment not to realize that.
You and I actually wrote a piece for The Forward about a year and a half ago making the same argument, saying, you know, if you care about blocking the rise of neo-fascism in Europe, your number one policy priority has to be to reverse and destroy austerity. And it's a stunning that, you know, again, this really shows that the failures in modern social democratic parties in Europe are, you know, much deeper than just sort of ideological adjustment, because if it was just ideological adjustment, they would have already pivoted back more fully now. But at any rate, and that point is very well taken, we still see, and obviously we're not idealizing the UK. The UK is in crisis and in shambles in many respects. But at the same time, we have an official government-sanctioned report, which, you know, sure, it's a government report. It's not an op-ed. It does not, you know, it does not explicitly call Tony Blair a liar. It does not, you know, all the rest. But the reality is that it's totally humiliating to Blair. It demonstrates that actually another important part of the Chilcot report is that even by the Bush-Blair metric, in other words, according to the report, even if these WMD stockpiles existed, which obviously they did not, the war would still be entirely unjustified on security and strategic grounds, let alone moral ones. So it's devastating. And in the Labor Party, yes, there's this attempted coup by, you know, think of these other politicians, like especially this MP Eagle, who's going to attempt to take on Corbyn. She's already getting heat from her grassroots. That's very serious. I mean, think of these politicians as like, you know, Tony Blair minus the charisma, right? Like they really have like nothing to offer, right? And so you have seen some public process of accountability. In the United States, you know, we certainly had a radical tonal and cultural shift with President Obama, which I think we should acknowledge that's not nothing. But from the beginning, we said, we're not going to investigate, I mean, let alone Iraq and the lies that led to the invasion of Iraq. We're not going to investigate torture. We're not going to investigate global war crimes. We're not going to scale back. In fact, many of the most sort of, you know, drone CIA programs will actually just make them legally codified, frankly. We have completely escaped that process of accountability in the United States. And it seems to me that it bleeds out from the highest reaches of foreign policy to the killings of Black and Hispanic people that we see on the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, well, I mean, first in terms of the, you know, the lack of accountability with the Iraq war stuff and the war on terror, I think as a culture, we have reticence to go down that road. We sort of think let's stick to the forward, let's stick to the future, not the past. If you start to wanting to, you know, reopen files and bring people, you know, in front of committees, you start to sound like a conspiracy theorist. You start to sound like, you know, you have sour grapes. I mean, I don't agree with that because I think we're talking about the cost of real human lives, both here and abroad, and so that is something we should be held accountable for, or the people in power should be held accountable for, but. There's a sort of quickness to bury things in the past and to move on. I think we have a little bit in our culture and that plays out in our political process. And I think it's a very dangerous thing, just, you know, for, you know, many reasons, one of which is that sure, the neocons are not in power like they were in the Bush administration, but we're still living quite clearly with the consequences of their actions and how that plays out with the police. I mean, you're already seeing debates about still raging on about the use of body cameras, the use of independent, inspector general's oversight of police. Here in New York, there's constant criticism from the police and the police unions of internal affairs, of the Civilian Complaint Review Board, the imposition of an inspector general, out of the idea that there's just, you don't want the police having to constantly swat down complaints from the public. And this is, it would seem to be the most Republican in the small R sense of the word, to have civilian accountability to the people who are given the most responsibility, because they are given arms and the ability to change people's lives quite dramatically.
To a sanctioned paramilitary power. I mean, that's not, you know, not that it isn't like a besmirchment of police. That's just quite literally what they are.
Absolutely. And, yeah. And I mean, obviously, I mean, it happened with Ferguson. You're right. Seeing it, you know, today in Baton Rouge with the use of militarized police against protests, that you would think that the American impulse would be to not want this kind of martial law through the streets. But I have a small bit of optimism in that regard. I mean, it's obvious. It was obviously posturing, but when former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich started to speak the language of race, you had articles in places like Red State, a conservative website, from a white writer saying, us as white people will never really truly understand what Black people have to experience when they encounter law enforcement. Perhaps minds are changing, perhaps it will be considered too reactionary, too out there to not acknowledge what's happening. But I think, to your general point, that we've never really set up an apparatus to oversee this, to rein this in, is why we're here today.
What is that apparatus? I mean, you've written a lot on policing issues, and you have, you know, a policy framework. And if we're going to take it on that, I mean, I think this, these are obviously also very much cultural and historical questions, but if you had a basic kind of policy overview of what we need to do to address this, what would be the three places we should start?
Well, one of the things that is kind of quirky about the U.S. and its policing is that for as large as it is, for as intense it is, as it is, it's incredibly decentralized. We don't really have very much federal broad law enforcement. Where you do, you have something like the FBI, which has very sort of specific guidelines in what it investigates. You have the ATF, which only oversees alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. Right. Or you have the marshals, who only go after fugitives. You have these federal agencies, but their roles are incredibly specific. So when it comes to the actual policing of life on the street, this is almost utterly at the mercy of local and state officials. So what you have is, well, really two problems. One is the federal government doesn't have that much control over what happens. They can, you know, they can launch investigations when there's pressure to do so, but these are sort of one-off things that often don't really have a lot of repercussions, across the country. And the other is that and this gets into a broader political issue, is that I think that the political left, and I include aspects of the Democratic Party in that, have sort of failed to prioritize state and local governments as ways, as real positions of power, to concentrate on federal races and the presidency. Mm-hmm. That the right, through groups like ALEC, the Koch brothers, have really taken control of state and local governments, and part of that has been to be in control of law enforcement. Now, it is true that one of the reasons why you have so much militarization of the police is due to a federal, a federal history of, taking arms that were meant for the military abroad and redistributing them domestically for the war on drugs and now the war on terror. But you don't really have any good federal mechanism to bring standards across the board. So for example, in Dallas, I mean, one of the big tragedies about Dallas was that that people were saying in the aftermath was that this actually was a police department that had been good about diversity hiring, right. De-escalation right. tactics, right. Whereas that wasn't happening through, other parts of the country. So there isn't really a broad agenda to do this, a mechanism.
I just want to note about Dallas that, one of the subtext, and obviously it's just, everything about what happened in Dallas, just horrible, but it's just sort of worth noting with everything else that until that attack and those murders, you had a great, vigorous protest. It was overseen by all accounts, an entirely professional, respectful, and great manner by the police. And then, in fact, the police responded, it took these murders and, got everybody at the protest that they could, to safety. And everybody across the board involved in that protest from, even people who said quite, bluntly, like, that they weren't surprised that this had happened in some form or another, to people who, but there was not a single person at that protest involved in it that did not obviously condemn those murders and condemn those killings. And the police, with regards to protesters in Dallas, were... everybody was doing what they were supposed to do. And actually, that's one of the sort of other kind of horrible ironies of that horrible event in Dallas, was that, everybody was sort of on target. As a final question here, the other thing that I think it points to, and I know you've also written about a lot, that these issues are, they're inextricably linked to race. They're also inextricably linked to inequality, because the killings of people like Alton Sterling and Eric Garner are also connected with this sort of criminalization of informal economies, which people increasingly need to seek out. Many people of color, but also, lower income people across the board who might not have specific types of training. They might have a past, criminal conviction. And laws have been written that really leave people exposed to extreme violence for doing something as insignificant as, selling a DVD or a loose cigarette. Seems like that's another important part of this, and I'd like your thoughts on that before we sign off.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a consequence. It's an economic consequence of the broken windows theory of policing that, well, if you go after the small crimes, you will take care of the bigger ones. And obviously the small crime that gets targeted is the hustle. And that, so if you go into poor communities of color looking for small crimes, you're going to find people who are operating those gig, you know, those off the grid economies, like you just said. I mean, I think the other piece of inequality that's often tied to it is excessive ticketing. In Ferguson, for example, there were people on both the left and right, I should say, from the libertarian right, who pointed out that one of the biggest problems that Ferguson, to deal with its budget problems, was just going to cover the city with tickets to use fines to fund public services.
Right.
So it's essentially a sort of austerity kind of motivated policing that not only drains money out of people who don't have much, but that increases the problems with, you know, that increases over enforcement and eventual confrontations with enforcement. So all that is just a really toxic mix that's, you know, that's going to end with someone like Eric Garner or any one of these incidents.
All right, Paul, where should people look to find more of your work?
You should check out my site at the Jewish Daily Forward, forward.com. I'm there about every 2 weeks. And I'm also on Twitter. Just look up my name and you'll find me.
And we have a link to it on our website at majority.fm. Ari, it's always a pleasure to talk with you and work with you, and appreciate it so much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, man. Okay, we are going to take a brief break, and we will be right back with the great Jimmy Dore.
Tried to tell Nick in 2012, Nick, working hand to hand and no avail. Volume 1 was too heavy for you frail, Nick. So I got lean like codeine and pills. It's the visionary in the vintage Chevy. It's been a while, but wow, you still care. Free Nash till they pass out obituaries and bold caps. Your was not there. And I could do anything but move backwards. The hardest thing is to keep from being distracted. My big sister still claiming me on the taxes. Tell Uncle Sam I just need a second to add this. Gave my mama 10 racks and she packed and went to chew mash with it. Could dribble the worth and gave me half of it. Half of it I tucked in the back of the air mattress. A quarter stash was stashed in a box with the Air Maxes. The rest got lost in sacks with my wife in no BM. Whack, dropping links in my DM. Bathroom, been down in TL. I'm glad that you finally made it to the future, but you late in the prices through the roof. If you want, you could wait outside the building. I ain't taking no more meetings.
Stepped in the water. The water was cold. She healed my body, but not my soul.
I bring you greetings from the First Church of Boone Baptist. United Fellowship of Free Nationals. Residing pastor is Die Pack. And the First Lady is a... sunglasses.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining me now is Jimmy Dore. He's the host of the Jimmy Dore Show on the Young Turks Network. Jimmy, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Michael. I'm just tweeting out right now to let people know that I am on the Majority Report, correct?
Incorrect. It's been a coup here. This is actually now... No, it's just Michael Brooks Show. What was the decision? You were just like, fuck it, Jimmy Dore Show.
Yeah, you know, I'm bad at picking names of things. Like, and I just like trying to pick names of my CDs, names of my specials, and I always fail. And I try to make them funny, or I try to make it just never works. And so I just decided I'm just going to go with the Jimmy Dore Show and just leave it at that. And that's how it happened. So, yeah, I don't know. It seems like a little bit of an ego trip, but a lot of people call their show, like, you know, there's Bill O'Reilly calls it the O'Reilly Report. That's not a
the O'Reilly Factor. The Factor.
Yeah, that's
the
fact.
The Factor.
And boy, they're having some fun times over there at the Fox News, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like, you know, some people use these murders and horrific opportunities to as opportunities to address the history of American apartheid and crimes against humanity, and others use it as an opportunity to sort of announce that they're in the Klan with somewhat nicer suits. So, I mean, yeah. And I like Bill O'Reilly's definitely on the like, look, I'll tell you how that's get killed by the police. This is how you do it.
Well, it's everything you thought about Fox News is being revealed. Like, oh yeah, of course they're all. But it's, you know what's interesting to me? We're talking, you know, about the Roger Ailes, Gretchen Carlson,
right?
Is, and of course Bill O'Reilly's already famously been caught and sexually harassing his a producer, and that
relentlessly,
you know, that got
relentlessly.
Yeah.
Like phone calls. Oh my, it's gross, man.
Yes, phone call. I mean, just, I mean, and the kind of, so you go, well, that didn't happen just once.
Right.
Like, that's what I thought with Bill O'Reilly. Like, so that didn't happen just once. He's been paying off people for a long time or giving them jobs. And of course that is, but it's, and it took Gretchen Carlson to say something.
It's so that's weird.
What, yeah, that's what, and she waited all this, I mean, who, I mean, did you? I mean, who would have thought that a news station that defends Christian values and parades leggy blondes to out to interview wife beaters would have a CEO that was a creep?
I said that in the intro to the show today that I was like, honestly, if somebody told me and they had like somebody came up to me and said, I have absolutely clear, definitive evidence that Roger Ailes has never sexually harassed a woman, I would be genuinely shocked. Like, before any of this happened, I'd be like, really? Like, what? Like, how could it not be that this whole network isn't run on...
Right.
And I want your thoughts on this, because I feel like you're kind of pointing to this. I don't want to be in a position, like, I read it, Gretchen Carlson dealt, and it wasn't just, you know, Roger Ailes, it was also that friggin' moron, her like co-host, that Ducey guy,
Ducey.
Right? Who's,
yeah.
Who really is like maybe the I mean, he's just the worst. And so I don't want to like minimize what she went through. It's absolutely horrible. But there is something weird about like there's an impulse on some people who are, I would say, anywhere from like the center to the more liberal side of the equation, where it's like on the right, they would take something that you and I said, like, hey, we need to have a more complex view of the Middle East. And they'd be like, see, you know, they support Al-Qaeda. On our side, we're like, we are always looking for like, you know, maybe Megyn Kelly, because she acknowledged one time that like Donald Trump is a total, you know, beyond dirtbag. Maybe right. She's actually kind of a good journalist. And now it's like, you know, Gretchen Carlson's really brave. And look, it's all, of course it is brave on some level, but it's like, how much do we really want to idolize people that worked at this network and pushed that agenda? I mean, I not in any way excusing what happened to them, but like they didn't just become like great heroes here. They were Fox anchors.
Like Gretchen Carlson didn't decide to say something until she no longer was getting money from them.
Right.
So that's what you're saying. That's what I thought. The first thing I'm like, first I was like, well, I didn't know Gretchen Carlson had that much integrity. Then I found out, no, it was because she actually got rid of her show, which I didn't even know. So I don't really follow Fox News. So I didn't know they had gotten rid of her. I didn't know she still had a show. I didn't know what was going on with Gretchen Carlson. So
that could have been the name of your show, Jimmy.
I don't know what's going on with Gretchen Carlson.
Yeah.
That should be the
name. Yeah. I like that.
That's my new podcast. Yeah. That's my new podcast.
I didn't know what was going on with Gretchen Carlson.
You know, if you want to know why, and a lot of the women apparently had sex with Roger Ailes.
Ugh. And Ugh.
Stop it!
Right when you think, right, because I know, right? But Roger Ailes, you know, he is 76 years old, but he only looks 97. And it's a youthful 97, isn't it? I mean, if you want to know why Gretchen Carlson said no to him, just Google a picture of the guy. Oh, my God.
Kelly would like to add something to this, and I think she will speak to all of our nausea. Yes.
Of course. I just threw up off to the side. But I just have to say that it's difficult to fault her for not speaking up until she was losing her job, because part of what you calculate in your mind as a woman if you are being sexually harassed, and I've had good experiences
with Roger Ailes
in professional office situations, but I worked in a lot of restaurants. And the calculation that you make is basically, you know, do I say something or do I go somewhere else where the same thing is just going to happen?
Wow.
So it's not about standing up for what's right.
What do you think,
Jimmy?
You think this is just the beginning? Like, we'll see across, like, harassment in other networks as well? I mean, because it can't be as abnormal.
It is absolutely.
Yeah. It must be quite normal.
Rampant and just and normal. And I mean, it, of course, Fox is going to, it's going to be more blatant there because of the way that they hire. He said, you know, he just hires based on looks. And so it's going, you're going to get more harassment there. But, you know, I'm sure that they all, that all of these women have to deal with some semblance of this.
You would like to think that at other news, that at news networks, where reporters are supposed to be reporters and they're supposed to be muckrakers and they're supposed to be people who aren't interested in a lot of money and not being popular. That's what, you know, that's what reporters are supposed to be. Right?
Psych.
So that's the problem with TV news. They're the exact opposite. There are people who are interested in money and being very popular and well-liked by the people they're supposed to be reporting on, which is why mainstream news journalism sucks hard everywhere. CNN, NBC, CBS, especially MSNBC. I see it because I watch that fucking train wreck that they call a news show over there. It is unbelievable. Do you think if Rachel Maddow and Michael and Chris Hayes had any balls whatsoever, they would be still working at that fucking garbage dump of a news network? That is unbelievable. The garbage that they, the pablum, they're pushing the TPP as a fucking news channel. They fired the one guy who was against it, who talked against it too loud. Did you hear Rachel say anything about that? Did you hear Chris Hayes say anything about that?
I have heard, because I can't catch Rachel as much. I have heard Chris criticize it a lot, but I think that, you know, it's part of it is tonal, but there's also just, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, look, it's cable news. I mean, these issues are going to show up regardless, but I want to get to before.
I don't know what that means.
Well, it means it's cable news, man. That's what it means. I mean,
it's horrible. It's horrible. You don't have to say anything. I'll say it. It is horrible. And it just, you know, and the fact that they still, like, talk to John Ralston like he's not a completely discredited joke of a joke. They call him the dean of reporting in Las Vegas. You know why? Because there isn't a fucking college of reporting in Las Vegas. That's why. He's the dean of college. He's the dean of reporting at the Trump University of Las Vegas. That's who John Ralston is.
Can we talk about the dean of former British prime ministers?
Oh, let's do.
Yeah, because I have some sound of Tony Blair in response. I don't know if you listened to it. I'm sure you have, Jimmy. But this is after the Chilcot report was released, which really was like, it's as devastating as an official government report is going to be about the conduct of a former head of state and a former prime minister. And Tony Blair goes before the cameras. And I want to listen to this first one where he basically is saying in this very particular Tony Blair way, sorry, not sorry. Let's listen to that.
For all of this, I express more sorrow, regret, and apology than you may ever know or can believe. Only two things I cannot say. It's claimed by some that by removing Saddam, we caused the terrorism today in the Middle East, and that it would have been better to have left him in power. I profoundly disagree. Saddam was himself a wellspring of terror, a continuing threat to peace and to his own people.
And to his own people.
If he'd been left in power in 2003, then I believe he would once again have threatened world peace. And when the Arab revolutions of 2011 began, he would have clung to power with the same deadly consequences that we see in the carnage in Syria today.
I like how it ends because he's basically like, I also have PST.
and I knew what was happening several years from hence, and therefore I took a decision. Sorry, not sorry.
Well, you know, when you decide to go into a war based on lies, in the end, you can only lie to yourself. Right. And that's what that is right there. Right,
right.
And what a nice tearjerker for him, you know? We should really feel sorry for Tony, not the hundreds of thousands who won't be able to relive his mistakes, but for Tony, because he has to relive his mistakes because he's still alive. Isn't that hilarious that he's talking about this other guy? He did that all through the speech, too, by the way. His whole thing is like, we got to keep our eye on these other guys. This guy, Saddam Hussein, he was a bad guy. And these Islamic terrorists, which Iraq will be a chapter of. That's what he said in that speech, too. Which are, as if Iraq was a chapter in the fight against Islamic terrorists. No, that is what broke open the Middle East, you knucklehead. You broke the Middle East by going into Iraq. It wasn't a fight. It wasn't a chapter in the fight against terrorism. It was a chapter of Western imperialism. That's what that was about. And so the fact that Edward Snowden is in jail and Private Manning is in jail. Tony Blair and George Bush and Dick Cheney still walk the earth free. It just goes to show you that in Western culture, which we like to say our culture is superior to other cultures, it just goes to show you that in our culture, exposing war crimes is considered worse than committing them.
Right. Exactly. I mean, I want to get to this other part. Do we have any parts where Tony Blair talks about the importance of taking a decision? The way he phrases it, which I'm going to use, by the way. I'm going to start using it. Like, I'm like, why did you run that red light? I mean, look, you have to take a decision. And frankly, like, who's this other girl you're texting? I mean, look, frankly, I had to make a decision. And from your perspective, you're hurt. From my perspective, it was a fantastic time.
You know,
sorry, not sorry.
I accidentally run. This is a true story. I accidentally ran, and I love dogs. I actually ran over my brother's dog about 20 years ago.
Oh, man.
I was accidentally. It was horrible.
But you had to take a decision, Jimmy.
But I had to take the decision. And so, you know, I'd do it again. I would run over his dog again.
He was a Doberman Pinscher. And I mean, we need to be serious about this.
And that running that dog over was just one of the chapters in our fight against canine extremism.
Well, you knew that in 12 years the dog was going to attack a kid at his playground.
And so, you know, if you say you wouldn't kill that dog, then you have to say what you think would happen if I didn't. And unless you're prepared to say what would have happened if I didn't kill that dog, then you're just a commentator.
It's one thing to say, oh, I would have given him bone, taken a walk. Look, that's the sidelines. That's around the sidelines. And I see all these people on the television saying, oh, my son was dismembered. My son was killed. And they're all fat and bloated. And I doubt their kids would have ever even made it to Davos. Sorry, not sorry.
You know, it was my most momentous decision I took as prime minister. How it went was the phone rang. It was George Bush. He said, "Are you in?" I said, "Sure." It was very momentous.
It was such. I was racking my brain because first I was in the middle of a meeting to see if we could somehow merge the NHS with Walmart, and then George called up and said, "Could we cook up some intelligence based off of PhD research saying that Saddam could nuke France?" And I said, well, if you'll forgive me, it's a Britishism, radio. But look, as the African-American so wisely said, I mean, Taylor Swift, haters gonna hate.
That is exactly what he made it sound like. That is exactly, no kidding. That is exactly what he made it sound like. Hey, haters gonna hate, but I gotta do my job.
Oh, there it is. You hear it? We got the track, Jimmy.
Yeah, I love it.
Oh, man.
And by the way, you go, well, why is he giving that speech? And why is Saddam Hussein dead? And it's because they won the war, right? It's because the Western, you know, as far as we didn't lose, and you know what I mean, the war. So if we would have lost that war and Saddam would have won, then he wouldn't be dead and they would be hanging Tony Blair. But that we won that war, just like, you know, we didn't get in trouble for firebombing Japan,
right?
You know, because we won the war, right? And then the people who lost the war, we tried them for war crimes. That's how war works, right?
Well, I mean, look, hashtag so, winning. Sorry, not sorry.
I love that. Sorry. That is so exactly sorry.
Sorry, not sorry, Tony Blair.
And sorry, not sorry. That is so perfect. So did you see the... Did you get to the part where he tries to talk about why he spends so much time in the Middle East?
Do we have that part? And, I guess we don't have. Why don't you explain that one to us? That is pretty amazing.
He talks about how you know how this really he cares about the Middle East. He really cares about the Middle East, you know?
And, you asked why I go back to the site of where I killed my friend. It's because I loved him so much.
That's good. And he literally said, some people wonder why I spend so much time in the Middle East. And this is why. This is why? You mean, I thought it was because you were avoiding getting subpoenaed for war crimes. That's what I thought.
If you take
guys are war crimes. So when you, and then he talked about how they needed to reform everything. It was unbelievable. It was like, I'm rubber and you're glue. So he talked about the UN and he said that we need to reform the UN. He said, he said, of course I think the UN should be deciding who should go to war and who shouldn't. But you know that they're deadlocked with Russia and the United States taking the opposite view of everything. So I just ignore the UN. That's what he's really saying. And he said, we need to reform it. No, we need to reform you. The UN was right about Iraq. They told you not to go into Iraq. They didn't give you authorization, so you went into Iraq. No, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael. That's called a war of aggression. And according to the Geneva Convention, the war of aggression is a war crime.
Kofi Annan, who is like the consummate, like if you looked up the platonic ideal of global diplomat, right? Like a guy who genuinely strived to have decent relationships with everybody from George Bush to Saddam Hussein to everyone in between. If you read his book, or go back to, I think it was 2004, and it like, you know, it pained him and ensured that he wouldn't get another term as Secretary General. He's like, it was illegal, period.
Yes,
I can't massage that for you. And he was like the U.S.'s choice in the 90s because he was more accommodating than Boutros Ghali. But he's like, look, I'm sorry. I'm not a hack. You know, I might be really conciliatory, but it is what it is. And that was unbelievable. Tony Blair took, you're right. He took two sections of the speech, which, by the way, why does he go to the Middle East? He goes to the Middle East because Kuwait appreciates that he got rid of Saddam, so he gets paid millions of dollars to do like a 30-page white paper on, you know, doing more with their oil industry or whatever, privatizing state assets. He's on retainer with the Saudis to facilitate deals with the Chinese. And his role as peace envoy was mainly going up to the Palestinians and being like, can't really do anything about the Gaza blockade, but I can do this. There's a great cell phone tower deal for Morgan Stanley.
I know.
That would work out fantastically for everyone. I mean, look, if you take the decision as...
Listen,
if you're a kid in Iraq... Go ahead. I'll do mine after you do yours. Go, man. It's too much fun.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
If you take the decision as a child in Iraq who had their arms blown off, maybe then it was a bad decision. But if you take it from my perspective as getting oral sex from Rupert Murdoch's wife in a hot tub in California and getting $30 million for a white paper for the Kuwaitis, taken in that light, it was a fantastic decision. And fundamentally, you have to take decisions. That's what leadership is. Sorry, not sorry.
The sorry, not sorry at the end is unbelievable. That is so funny. That is nice work, Michael.
Thank you.
That is nice work.
Yeah. Oh my God. Oh.
Like, I can't really help you, Palestinians, but the world needs carbonated water. Would you like to make it?
Not really much I could do on the children nutrition front, but I can hook you up with some brilliant chaps who would like to frack off of the Gaza Sea. Anyone interested? Sorry, not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. Oh my God. And at least George Bush is like chilling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess they didn't come out with a report, you know, aimed at him.
No, we don't do that here.
But the thing is that the Chilcot guy who did their report, now, I don't, you know, I don't know that much about the Britain politics. I don't even know what constitutes Britain, UK, or England. I don't know what the difference really is between those three. I'm an American, so, I only speak one language, and I don't know much about foreign countries. But now I'm forgetting what my point was.
Well, yeah, you got distracted by self-deprecation. Oh, wait, guy, yeah, go. What's the point?
That guy, Chilcot, he was a friend of Blair. I think he was a supporter of Blair's, wasn't he? Weren't they on the same team?
I don't know. I think Chilcot's just a government, you know, kind of Mandarin veteran. And basically what happened was you know, Gordon Brown, who I have to say, Gordon Brown, who was Tony Blair's second in command. And, and he went along with Iraq and everything else. But, his main thing that he did as prime minister, to be honest, was he was the guy who basically saved the world economy in between even Bush and Obama. And he actually did bank nationalization in the UK and did some stimulus. And then he basically on one hand, and not to over-idolize the guy, but on one hand, he's Tony Blair's second in command and Tony Blair's screwing him over. Although he seems like the only guy who ever actually intimidated Tony Blair besides George Bush. And then this poor Scottish bastard then loses to David Cameron. Could you imagine having your career sandwiched between those two guys?
You're right, right.
He's this poor guy. And you're he's walking around lumbering, no, you don't understand. Tony was evil. I was trying to save us all.
Yeah.
What was it like at the time? Because, I don't remember how old I was. But, I was obviously following this. But, I remember the other thing that's worth remembering about Tony Blair, because it gets back to the earlier criticism of the press. You know, when this was happening, Tony Blair was the cover for the Democrats who wanted to support the invasion. They would say, sure, Bush is a moron, but Tony Blair is so articulate.
Yes, that is correct. That is exactly what happened. Yeah, that's right. And then people kept... So when you have the Democrats in Congress going along with it, and then you have Tony Blair, who's supposed to Americans think he's a liberal in England, and he's so articulate and smart, and he could be, so that's what it was, and he was charming, and he spoke, when he speaks, he has the ability to like a good politician, he appears sincere and in earnest, and we all know that that's also a trademark of a narcissistic psychopath, which is what he is. Tony Blair. He's a narcissistic psychopath war criminal who doesn't have the ability to, because narcissists can't ever admit they're wrong. And this is it. I mean, right there, if you ever need to see, people say Donald Trump is a narcissist because he can never say he's wrong. Well, it's the same thing with Tony Blair, except he knows how to be charming when he's doing it, unlike Donald Trump, who can't help but act like a reality TV star.
Right.
So you're right, Michael. It was Tony Blair and people forget, they still try to do this thing about how, hindsight. Well, in that report, because that's what Tony Blair keeps saying, hindsight. But in that report, the Chilcot said, no, you do not need hindsight. All this stuff was told to you before that this was going to happen, that he didn't have. And by the way, Tony Blair in the Chilcot report, when he gave the dodgy dossier to Parliament, what that means was that he took all the information that his intelligence experts gave him and twisted it in a summary at the beginning of the report that he handed to Parliament. And he twisted it saying, look, they say there is weapons of mass destruction. They should say we should invade, and they didn't. And what the Chilcot report also points out is it chastises those intelligence people for not speaking up when they saw Tony Blair twisting their words. And they did, so everybody was in on it, right? So the same thing that happened over here. And you can't tell me that Hillary Clinton, when she voted for the Iraq war, really thought that Saddam Hussein was the threat to the United States.
No, well, that's the other. That's the other part of it, Jimmy. Is that like, and I just going back to it historically, it was like simultaneously they're saying in selling that war, and everybody who went along with it was simultaneously saying like, this will be over in 3 weeks. There's no there's no army there. The people are gonna love. I mean, it's funny. We say like Trump. It really was like. You could do Tony Blair Trump. Like, it's going to be fantastic. It's going to be quick. Believe me, the Iraqis will love it. Like, it's the same thing, yeah. Right? And then on the other hand, they have a weapons program which could spell doom for the entire globe in a matter of days. And it was like, how could you sell those two things at the same time? Like, how is that even possible?
Oh, you know, Michael, how come I never heard it put that way before? You're the first guy I've ever heard make that observation. That's a great observation. No one's ever made that point to me before. Yeah, that's right. They're fighting both ends of that argument.
Yeah,
you know?
It's crazy.
One parallel to the Hillary Clinton campaign, please. Is it the same thing they did with Hillary? It's the same thing they did with the Hillary Clinton campaign, right? It's when you know you're trying to defend something that you don't really believe in, mm-hmm. you argue from all different angles, just right. like the Iraq War. So they did the same thing with Hillary, in a sense, when they said, well, like people who I know, they go, well, I agree with Bernie's policies, but I'm going to support Hillary because she's a stronger candidate, right? She's a stronger candidate. Even though Bernie pulled better, still does, right, against Donald right. Trump. And now they tell Bernie, hey, you better get behind her because now you're hurting because she's been tough. She's Teflon. She's been tested for 30 years. Their attacks can't hurt her. All of a sudden, this guy, Bernie Sanders, he's hurting her. You got to drop out. You're bringing her. So you can't have it both ways. You can't right. have it. I'm supporting her because she's Teflon and she's tested. And also, you have to shut up because you're hurting her. So that's when you know that the thing they're defending, they don't believe in. Same thing with Tony Blair. Same thing with the people for the Iraq War. That's a great observation, Mike. You should write a book.
Oh, well, can I co-write one?
You should. Sure, I'll co-write one.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's camp up somewhere in one of Rupert Murdoch's houses, hang out with his wife, smoke some weed, and write a book.
Does he have a new wife?
I does actually. I don't know what the situation with it, but that was when I found out, and I know it's not 100% confirmed, so I should add that caveat. But with the whole Tony Blair and Rupert Murdoch's wife thing, I remember it was so weird because one part of me was like, "All right, there's something that Tony Blair did that I can have some respect for," and then another part of me was like, "I actually genuinely feel like Rupert Murdoch was wronged," which feels so weird. like Tony Blair, he was like, Wendy, why don't we, while we're actually in bed together, why don't I call Rupert and get money from my foundation, and then you call Rupert to say that you're doing well, just to add an element of humiliation to the proceedings. Sorry, not sorry.
What? I didn't, you know, my, so I didn't realize that this was a real thing.
Oh no, that was about a couple years ago. That was a serious, like, it was, and we only got a couple more minutes, but yeah, that was in Vanity Fair. They published a diary that Wendy Deng put out where she talked about how attracted she was to Tony Blair, and there were all of these like circumstantial things, like they were together at a house that Murdoch owned at the same time, but Murdoch wasn't there. And then when he found out about it, it correlated with him, you know, divorcing her. I mean, again, it's not, you know, it's not like you can just say that happened, but there's pretty strong circumstantial evidence.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing.
Wow.
Right?
Wow. That is pretty amazing. Wow.
Glad to brighten your day, Jimmy.
No, that is, I thought that those were just jokes you were making that were really funny, that, you know, obviously this is what,
no, it's based on true.
Tony Blair and...
No, it's based on reality. It's based on reporting.
God, that makes that. Wow, that makes it even funnier.
Yeah. Hey, Rupert, I'm doing great. How are you? Will the check clear for the interfaith dialogue? Hold on 1 second.
Well, you know what? It's so funny that Yeah, you bring up the dialogue for peace between faiths, because he brought that up in his speech too, when he said, some people, why I spend so much time in the Middle East, this is why, and he said, it's why I work on the dialogue for peace between faiths. Tony Blair, the leader who is responsible for murdering thousands of innocent people, you are probably not the guy that's helping the interfaith dialogue.
No, he was, but that's his main, that's his, and then what's funny is that, I mean, just, you know, the whole thing, the way it works, because he goes and he makes all these money, all this money, ironically, in many cases, advising dictators, like in Kazakhstan, and then he'll say, like, well, most of this money doesn't go to me personally. It goes to fund my efforts, like the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. Just like, I mean, it's incredible. You know, the thing that's amazing about him, though, is that, you know, with Bill Clinton and the Global Initiative, and this is, you know, my own experience with it, is that they, I know people who've worked there, and they actually do. I'm not just saying it. They do some really good work. And then there's some really questionable things that is involved with the funding of it, right? And then with Blair, it's like the reverse. Yeah. With Blair, it's like, with Clinton, it's sort of like, yeah, we did this great AIDS initiative. And then, yeah, there was a questionable meeting about a mining contract, yeah, whatever. With Blair, it's like, no, no, no. The mining contract was the point. Yeah, yeah, faith dialogue, whatever. The mining contract. That was the real thing. We did this great thing in Mongolia where we socially cleansed a village. Then, sorry, not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry.
Sorry, Jimmy. Can we do this again many times? And it's a lot of fun.
Oh, this
man.
Is great.
Yeah,
this is great. The time flew by, Michael. Thanks for having me on. You're hilarious.
Thanks a million, brother. See, talk to you soon. Bye,
okay,
Jimmy.
Okay, thanks a million, dead Iraqi. Sorry, not sorry.
That'll be our new back and forth for everything. Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. Talk soon, man.
Bye. Bye, buddy.
Sorry, not sorry. Wow, it's horrible. Okay, we're gonna go. We're gonna go to the fun half, although I don't think that will be as fun as that interview. We'll get back to reporting on police murders. Sorry, not sorry. I think that's a new thing.
That's only one of two that we've.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Might have another character. You might, if you're in the fun half.
If you're in the fun half, another character's coming. There's a new Two Dope Boys dropping tomorrow. It was very intense, actually. We recorded it on Sunday. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Become a member of the Majority Report today. 256-257-3920. Majority.fm/become a member. Majority Report Kickback. That is where you can find our Amazon link, our Jet.com link, JustCoffee.coop. All sorts of great ways that you can support the show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Don't miss our YouTube channel. If you're missing out on our YouTube channel, you're missing out on a really a whole different way of appreciating and enjoying the show. That is YouTube. YouTube/isitmajorityreport/Sam Cedar now?
No, it's Sam Cedar.
It's still Sam Cedar. It's YouTube/Sam Cedar. Several new videos a day, including sometimes videos that are YouTube exclusive. Okay, we'll see you all in the fun half.